Welcome to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm your volunteer reader, Neil Kelly. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines from the Valley and the State and USA Today. Our first headline is titled, Preston Lord Was Attacked 2 Years Ago. Here's where the murder case stands. By Elena Santa Cruz and Robert Anglin, Arizona Republic. October 28, 2023 was the day 16-year-old Preston Lord and his friends decided on a whim, like hundreds of other teenagers, to pull up to a Halloween party in Queen Creek and have fun. That's not how the night ended. 2 years ago, Lord and his friends crossed paths with a gang of teens who had a reputation for violence, the Gilbert Goons. Lord was knocked to the ground with a punch to the face. Then his attackers descended on him, hammering his face, kicking, and stomping him. The teen was left lying in the street near 194th Street and Via del Rancho. "I'm scared. I don't know what to do," a boy told a 911 dispatcher that night. He cried and said a friend of his had a broken wrist and another was unconscious on the ground. "Are people on the way? I need them to get here. I do not want my friend to die." Lord, a popular student leader and basketball player at Coombs High School in Santan Valley, died 2 days later of traumatic brain injuries. His parents have longed for their son, who would have turned 18 in September, ever since. The past 2 years have been excruciating, filled with constant reminders of the milestones that have been denied. Prom, graduation, college, move-in day, and all the moments in between, said Brian K. DeFusco, a lawyer for the Lords, in a statement. They are living every parent's worst nightmare, forced to carry a grief no family should ever have to endure. Lord's death shocked the suburbs of the Southeast Valley. It was the first homicide case for the newly formed Queen Creek Police Department, and it exposed a pattern of teen violence and gang assaults that went unchecked by authorities in the region. A December 2023 investigation by the Arizona Republic tied Lord's death to the goons, who recorded their blitz-style attacks on teens in parks and parking garages, outside fast-food restaurants, and at house parties. Most beatings occurred in Gilbert. The investigation led police to reopen shelved beating cases and initiate new ones. More than 24 arrests were made in the beating cases, about half of which were criminally charged. Nearly all those charged received probation for their participation in the attacks. Since then, Preston's Law was passed by the Arizona legislature and signed into law to increase penalties for goon-style attacks. Queen Creek police in March 2024 arrested 7 people who witnesses singled out as being responsible for the attack on Lord: Treston Biley, William Owen Hines, Jacob Meisner, Talon Renner, Taylor Sherman, Dominic Turner, and Talon Vigil. Billy, Meisner, and Turner were also charged with aggravated robbery in connection with a necklace that was stolen from Lord's friend as the attack unfolded. Hines is the only one who has admitted a role in the beating. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison in May after pleading guilty to manslaughter. The others have pleaded not guilty. Here's where the criminal case stands. When will the trial in the Preston Lord case begin? The trial for the murder case has been scheduled to begin in January 2026. It was originally set for July, but defense lawyers had said for months that this was unrealistic, given the volume of evidence that needed to be reviewed. There were hundreds of teens at the Queen Creek party. Of the 6 still facing charges, Meisner is the only one who remains in custody. The others were released after posting bail in various amounts. Vigil, who was the first to post bail in April 2024, was arrested by Gilbert police in September on suspicion of violating a protection order, a misdemeanor. He was accused of contacting, both in person and online, someone he wasn't supposed to, according to a spokesperson for the department. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office and the county's pretrial department were notified because of Vigil's pending criminal case, the spokesperson said. The next in-person court hearing, where lawyers were expected to share updates, was set for November 12th, which is also the court-ordered deadline for any defense motions to sever a defendant's case from the others. Most of the people charged in Lord's killing and some of their parents are also facing wrongful death claims filed on behalf of Lord's parents. Hines and Vigil agreed to settle. The couple whose children hosted the Halloween party also faced negligence claims, but agreed to settle. Friends, family, and community members were expected to participate in a Light the Night walk on October 28th to honor Lord and educate the public about teen violence. It was set to begin at the Queen Creek Police Department at 6 p.m. The next article is titled, What is Proposition 409? What to Know About November 4th Maricopa County Election Question, by Stephanie Innes, Arizona Republic. Dr. Carol Olson, as the chair of the Psychiatric Department for Valleywise Health, is a daily witness to what she calls a dire need for inpatient beds, where community members experiencing a mental health crisis can stay. College-age people experiencing their first episode of psychosis and unhoused people who have been picked up by the police because they are threatening violence or common scenarios. If they don't have enough understanding of their condition to realize a need for treatment, they will typically require a court-ordered psychiatric evaluation and an inpatient bed while they wait for the evaluation. Holson wants the community to know that getting care for such people is why plans to build a new psychiatric hospital on the Central Phoenix Valleywise campus are so essential as the county's population grows. Valleywise is the public health system for Maricopa County, and it is the subject of the only countywide measure that will appear on the November 4th all-mail election ballot for Maricopa County, Proposition 409. Valleywise Health, which serves a disproportionately high percentage of uninsured and underinsured patients, is the only hospital system in Maricopa County that accepts patients in need of a court-ordered psychiatric evaluation, Olson said. Every day, she said, there's a waiting list for one of those beds that rarely goes below 40 people. Those people are waiting at local psychiatric emergency rooms or other emergency rooms. If we don't have enough beds to admit these people to, they can't be held indefinitely, Olson said. They could be released back to the community without having an evaluation or treatment if we cannot accommodate them. Proposition 409 asks whether Maricopa County property owners will finance nearly $900 million in improvements for Valleywise Health, which is in the midst of replacing and expanding its aging facilities at the main Valleywise campus on East Roosevelt Street near 24th Street in Central Phoenix. A key project that's part of Proposition 409 is replacing a 93-bed, two-story inpatient psychiatric hospital on the southeastern part of the campus that was built in 1976 and opened in 1978. If the Proposition 409 passes, it will finance construction of a new $220 million, 200-bed psychiatric facility that's closer to the main hospital than the existing building. Being close to the main hospital is important for psychiatric patients who also have serious medical conditions that are more complicated than what most psychiatric hospitals can handle, problems such as needing dialysis or who have multiple serious wounds or need physical therapy, for example. There aren't other psychiatric hospitals locally that will take those people, Olson said. I feel like it's important that Maricopa County voters recognize that it's not a good thing to operate with a lack of those beds. Voters must mail their ballots back by October 28th, according to the Maricopa County Elections Department. In an all-mail election, all voters will automatically be mailed a ballot. Voters have the option to return it by mail, drop it off at a secure ballot drop box, or vote a replacement ballot in person. County election officials say ballot replacement centers are for people who damage their ballot or who want to vote in person. Visit locations.maricopa.vote to find a ballot replacement center or secure Dropbox. Here are answers to six common questions about Proposition 409, which has no organized opposition and bipartisan support from a range of community leaders, including Republican former Arizona Governors Doug Ducey and Jan Brewer, the Professional Firefighters Association of Arizona, the Arizona Fraternal Order of Police, and Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays. How much will it cost taxpayers? On average, Proposition 409 would add approximately 11 cents per $100 of assessed limited property value per year to property owners' secondary property taxes. That works out to, on average, about $29 annually for an average county residential property owner and about $295 per year for an average county commercial property owner, Valleywise officials said. While people who don't own property won't be taxed, the extra costs could be passed on by landlords to tenants. Is the new psychiatric hospital the only thing Proposition 409 will finance? No, it's one of three components of the ballot question. In addition to the $220 million for a new psychiatric hospital, the bond issue would finance $500 million for outpatient health facilities, including rebuilding neighborhood clinics, replacing an outpatient specialty care clinic, and adding an outpatient surgery center, plus $170 million for expanding Valleywise's main hospital, which opened in 2024 including building out the 10th floor and adding observation beds to add capacity in the emergency department. No one in my family has mental health issues, so why should I pay? These are unique beds that are a resource to our community that serve many purposes, not just for the people who get the help, but for public safety, Olson said. It's not a hopeless situation. Our average length of stay is 3 weeks. We are not usually institutionalizing people. The sad part, she said, is when people don't get help in time. They may end up committing a crime, and it leads them to being stuck in jail. Will my tax dollars be financing health care for undocumented people? Every hospital in the United States is governed by a federal law that requires them to give emergency treatment to anyone who needs it. But with regard to psychiatry specifically, the percentage of our patients who are undocumented is very low, Olson said. Probably less than 5%. We do have some people who come in who are undocumented who are clearly legal residents, but they've been chronically homeless and lost their ID in the distant past, and it can take a long time to get it back. Don't Maricopa County residents already pay taxes for ValleyWise Health? Yes, county property owners already pay a tax levy for ValleyWise operations that was extended in 2020 via Proposition 449 and for a prior ValleyWise bond authorization that voters approved in 2014. Proposition 480 in 2014 authorized a $935 million county hospital expansion bond. The 2014 bond paid for the new $463 million ValleyWise Health Medical Center, which opened in 2024. It also paid for the purchase and renovation of a hospital in Maryvale, which now serves three purposes: as a ValleyWise Behavioral Health Center Maryvale for psychiatric patients, as a 24/7 community emergency department for adults and children, and as an outpatient behavioral health clinic. Population growth over the past 11 years since Proposition 480 means more hospital beds are needed, which is why there's a Proposition 409, Olson said. If Proposition 409 passes, future tax totals costs for ValleyWise, adding up Proposition 409, Proposition 449, plus the Proposition 480 bond from 2014, would be about $100 per year for an average residential homeowner and $1,006 per year for an average county commercial property owner. The numbers are estimates, since tax rates and average property values can change. When is the new psychiatric hospital supposed to open? ValleyWise plans to start building the new psychiatric hospital in approximately 2028. By that time, health system leaders hope to have adequately solved another problem aggravating the inpatient psych beds shortfall. The health system doesn't have enough behavioral health staff to keep its supply of beds open because of shortages that have plagued ValleyWise since the COVID-19 pandemic. The next article is titled, "Is it legal to bring dogs into Arizona grocery stores? Here's the law," by Ray Covarrubias Jr., Arizona Republic. Dogs in grocery carts may be cute, but are they allowed in Arizona stores? Under Arizona law, grocery stores are considered food establishments, which means there are strict rules to ensure safe food handling, according to Arizona Administrative Code and its incorporated FDA food code. Grocery stores must allow strict hygiene standards to comply with health codes and avoid violations that could impact their operations. Here's a look at what Arizona laws say about Fido's possible trip to the grocery store. What does Arizona law say about dogs and other animals in grocery stores? Arizona follows the FDA food code, which defines a food establishment as an operation that stores, prepares, packages, serves, vends, or otherwise provides food for human consumption. Grocery stores fit that definition, meaning pets aren't allowed inside, according to the FDA food code section 6-501.115. The code also means that grocery store employees cannot handle dogs or service animals and must wash their hands if they must handle one, according to Section 2-403.11. Are there any exceptions to the law? Yes, the law makes a few allowances for pet owners who want to take their animals into a grocery store. Service dogs, as defined by the Americans with Disabilities Act, are permitted in areas where food isn't prepared. Emotional support animals do not qualify as service animals under ADA or Arizona law. Pets are allowed in outdoor patios that have received approval from the County Health Department. Maricopa County has a dog-friendly patio permit program. Approved patios must have a separate entrance from the rest of the business, and food preparation is prohibited on the patio. What should you do if you have a question? Phoenix residents could contact the Maricopa County Environmental Services Department by calling 602-506-6616. Our next article is titled, Can a Once Controversial Restaurant Now Proceed in Old Town Scottsdale? By Sean Raimundo, Arizona Republic. The movers behind a proposed restaurant redevelopment project in Old Town Scottsdale are looking to succeed where another investor recently tried and failed. Samir and Alvin Yono, a father and son real estate management team, purchased a sliver of land in the entertainment district last year so they could turn a long-shuttered bar into a two-story restaurant and lounge, tentatively called LV's. They're asking the city's design review board to okay their remodeling plans, which include adding a second-story patio with an open slatted roof and floor-to-ceiling windows. The goal is for it to be a nicer, upscale restaurant, said Vanessa Yono, Samir's daughter, who manages the family's real estate operations. If approved, the project will replace the former Three Wise Men Bar located on the southwest corner of Schumann Lane and Wells Fargo Avenue. That's the same 0.13-acre site of an ill-fated restaurant project that one of Scottsdale's most prominent developers got squashed in January 2024, thanks to a deciding vote by the city's then-mayor. Through their new limited liability company, Jeep Gibro, the Yono family purchased the property in October 2024 for more than $5 million, expanding the list of developments they own and manage around the valley. They submitted their redevelopment proposal this past month and are waiting for the city staff to review the plans, providing feedback and schedule a hearing with review board. What's planned for the Old Town Scottsdale site? With their new property, the Yonos intend to lease the space to a restaurateur who they hope will operate a high-end eatery. Before that can happen, they need to make some improvements to the building, which, as they described in their application to the city, is worn and unattractive. The exterior needs a little bit of love, Vanessa Yono said. Inside, they want to make tenant improvements, and then up top, they want to create a rooftop patio that'll either be enclosed or covered. It's still a little early, but we just liked the idea of having more seating, more patio space. There's only a really small patio on the main floor. It's pretty tiny, she said, later adding, we're looking to make it look a lot nicer for the community, for that area. Lauren Proper Potter is the Yono family's attorney representing them on the project. She noted that even with the addition of the rooftop patio, the project is 30 feet, well below the 36-foot limit in the zoning law allows on the site. The Yono family and their representatives have stressed that the project will live within the existing zoning regulations and therefore should avoid any controversy or significant challenge. That wasn't the case, however, for the site's previous owner, former football player and investor Aaron Wagner. What happened to Wagner's abandoned project? After purchasing the site for $4.5 million in 2021, Wagner wanted to build Swags, a three-story fine dining eatery that would have served caviar and A5 Wagyu steak. He asked the city for an exception to the two-story height limit for which the building is zoned. While he won over support from his neighbors, city staff, and most elected leaders, Wagner couldn't sway Sean Yari, who owns more than a fifth of the properties around the site. Yari is opening a similar fine dining restaurant a block away, and the $150 million Maya Hotel development across the street from where Swags would have sat. In January 2024, he boxed out the would-be competition after formally protesting Wagner's request. Doing so meant that Wagner needed to secure at least 5 votes from the 7-member city council, rather than 4, as required by state law. He fell 1 vote shy of the threshold, however, with former mayor David Ortega delivering the deciding vote. While some believed that Yari didn't want to face any competition, he and his attorney, Tim Lasota, rejected such an assertion, arguing that Swags would become a noisy bar and take up limited parking nearby. Without the council's approval to raise the building height, Wagner couldn't proceed with the project. His company, Wags Capital, sold the property to the Yono family. To David Leibowitz, the Yono's spokesperson, the latest project shouldn't be on the same trajectory as the Swags project. It is very much trying to live within the present zoning, do a little bit of a refresh for the next tenant, and then operate a restaurant in a neighborhood where, frankly, there's a lot of restaurants, he explained. Lasota wasn't immediately available to provide a comment on the Yono family proposal. Who are the Yonos? The Yonos comprise Samir and his children, Alvin and Vanessa. In May 2015, Alvin Yono pleaded guilty to 3 counts of pandering and 1 count of attempted pandering, all felonies for which he served prison time, the Arizona Republic reported. 5 other counts were dismissed that August. Alvin Yono was released in October 2017. Alongside his sister and father, Alvin Yono owns and manages many Valley properties under various limited liability companies, according to the real estate database, VISDA, and the Arizona Corporation Commission. In Scottsdale, specifically, the Yonos have managed developments since 1986, according to Vanessa. "I feel like we have all different variations of tenants and everything," she explained, adding, "We've been doing this for a really long time." The next article is titled, "How a Tough Upbringing in Southern Arizona Shaped One of Tucson's Top Muralists," by Sarah Lapidus, Arizona Republic. Downtown Tucson is decorated with brightly colored murals painted by a largely self-taught man who overcame a tough childhood to become one of Southern Arizona's top artists. Ignacio Garcia, 47, is the artistic genius behind many of Tucson's iconic murals. He credited much of his success to surviving difficult experiences in his childhood, from fighting racist harassment in a rural town to figuring out how to survive in one of Phoenix's roughest areas. "Survival mindset is what got me to this, where I'm at, because I wasn't afraid to take these chances," he said. After the traumatic experiences he went through growing up, "How much worse can it be?" he asked. Childhood in rural Arizona marred by racism. Garcia was born in Agua Prieta, Mexico, a town on the Arizona-Mexico border. His mother left his alcoholic and abusive father when Garcia was 4, relocating to the U.S. His mother, who worked as a housekeeper, often struggled to put food on the table, moving with Garcia from home to home in housing projects just outside of Sacramento, California. They eventually moved in with extended family members in Pomerine, a town just outside of Benson in southern Arizona. There he lived in a trailer next to a slaughterhouse with 12 other family members before moving to a house in Benson. At 6 years old, he started drawing on his own. As he got older, he worked his way up, from colored pencils and markers to learning how to use acrylics when he was in his 20s. While his area had Latino and Mexican-American families, he remembers being one of the only families that had immigrated recently from Mexico. "We were Mexican. My Nana was making tortillas in the backyard," Garcia recalled. "When you stand out that much, people are curious and are going to say something." He recalled one time a brick was thrown through his window with a note that featured a racial slur and told his family to go back home. But it wasn't until he was physically attacked as a freshman in high school, which he says was racially motivated, that he knew he had to leave the small town behind. "It was a little dark time in my life that affected me, but for the most part, I love Benson. I still go to 4th of July there," Garcia said. Work as a DJ for celebrities preceded art. After the incident, he moved with his aunt to Phoenix's South Side and attended East Valley Institute of Technology in Mesa, where he studied commercial arts, or art for commercial use like graphic design. There, he also learned the basics of Photoshop and other art techniques. There, they lived in housing projects in a rough area overrun with gang violence. After saving enough money to leave Phoenix and a stint working at a radio station in Tucson, Garcia moved to Los Angeles, when he was 25, to dive into the music scene. He lived there on and off for 10 years, moving between L.A., Phoenix, and Tucson. He worked as a DJ at clubs, opened for celebrities, worked as a tattoo artist, and lived the party like a rock star life, he said. Garcia also painted portraits of celebrities he crossed paths with, like Eminem, Jay-Z, and others. Little by little, he started gaining recognition for his portraits, he said. In Tucson, a well-connected local man heard about his celebrity portraits from Garcia's sister and asked if Garcia could do his. Garcia said the man loved the portrait so much, he asked if he could paint a mural on the ceiling in his home. Garcia had never painted a mural on a ceiling before, and what he thought would take 2 weeks took 3 months. After completing the project, word spread about his talent. Since then, work has come his way nonstop, he said. He currently has a months-long wait list for new projects. He has around 45 murals throughout Tucson. In his murals, he seeks to highlight culture, history, community, a voice, and a representation of Tucson's identity, he said. He noted that his art is like a mirror image of what I see and what I think what Tucson is. Kate Marquez met Garcia 17 years ago while working at an art-profit nonprofit now called Art State Arizona. She is the chief executive officer of the organization, which seeks to foster art initiatives and events across the state. She now considers him a close friend. Of all the artists I have ever met, there's nothing he can't do, yet he constantly is the most humble, she said. Marquez said what separates him from the other muralists she's worked with is how broad his range is. He has painted ceilings to look like the Vatican, as well as comic book characters and beautiful florals. It's not only his wide breadth of talent that makes him a standout artist, but also his kindness and willingness to collaborate on and teach his process to others, she said. Garcia's 15-year-old son, Val Garcia, is following in his footsteps and becoming an artist in his own right. He said he loves drawing and making music. He has helped his father with murals since he was 12 years old. Val said he wants to be known like my dad in downtown. I want to be like the kid of downtown, Val said, noting that his father pushes him to think outside the box with his art. Val added his father is fun, creative, and outgoing. He really is very social. People usually know him as the guy who does all the murals in downtown. Val's inspiration from his father reflects Garcia's overarching desire to inspire young artists and show them how their art can be turned into a business, Marquez said. More leaders like him in that space are just going to make this community better. Next, we have an article titled, How Nation's First Skate Park Was Built in Arizona. This is the story of Dry Surf, by Paige Moore, Arizona Republic. To the naked eye, one may not assume that the scorching desert would be the pioneer land to skateboarding in the 1960s, but you'd be wrong. Arizona is widely considered to be home to the world's first official skate park, Dry Surf. The park opened in Tempe in the summer of 1965 and completely revolutionized the skating game. Before the park's opening, skateboarding was mainly composed of Californians, largely due to the popularity of surfing. Surfers wanted to transfer the feeling of the waves onto the asphalt, even calling skateboarding asphalt surfing in its early years. As the sport gained more traction, it eventually moved east from the West Coast to the Valley, resulting in the birth of Dry Surf Skate Park. Dry Surf's memory is being honored with a new museum exhibit at the Tempe History Museum. The idea for the exhibit was brought to life after the documentary High Rollers, The Golden Age of Skateboarding, was shown at the museum in 2023. Rob Locker, a longtime Arizona skater and visual director and marketer of the High Rollers documentary, is one of the curators of the Dry Surf exhibit alongside Josh Roffler. Roffler, Tempe History Museum manager, may not be a skater, but he is a longtime Valley resident and understands the impact of skate culture in Arizona. I like to say the skateboard community made it happen, Roffler said. It's a community project. The exhibit is filled with artifacts all borrowed from Arizona skaters from back in the day. Relics from the past display Arizona's rich skateboard history. Old boards and Thrasher magazines can be seen on display, as well as gear from Patty McGee, the world's first professional female skater. Our main thing was trying to tell the whole story, which we knew we couldn't, so we tried to touch a little bit on each and every little thing, said Locker. Although Locker, now 58 years old, wasn't there for Dry Surf Skate Park's opening in 1965, he still remembers a lot of the early days of skating. Locker recalls all of the devious ways him and his friends would find their new skate park spot when he was younger. Back then, one of the most sought-after skate spots were the full pipes, which were a key part of the Central Arizona Project's 1970s effort to bring Colorado River water to the valley. The pipes were built on site, then placed underground for water to be pushed through. However, the time frame in between the pipes being built and then put underground gave Arizona skaters the perfect advantage to shred the iconic full pipes. My buddy called up SRP or somebody back then and just was saying, "Hey, I'm doing a report for my high school, and I was wondering if you could give me some of the information about the locations of some of these big projects going on," Locker said. That's how they found out where these pipes were. These smooth pipes were skate nirvana back in the day and are remembered fondly by Arizona's skate pioneers. Before skating became the mainstream Olympic sport it is today, parks were hard to come by and often got shut down because of insurance issues. Skaters were seen as public annoyances and were often chased off by cops at any given point. This left skaters to their own devices. Arizona has a million pools, so that means a couple thousand are probably dry at one time. And we just had an affinity to skateboarding, the need to make it happen, and took chances, said Locker. Locker recalls early days of breaking into abandoned pools and running from cops, though never getting arrested. This self-reliant rebel ideology is what makes skate culture iconic and connects the sport with punk music. Locker is not only a skater, but the owner of AZPX, a Phoenix merchandising and skate company. AZPX does all merchandising JFA and Sun City Girls. JFA was the first record label to have its own skateboarding brand, according to Locker. A lot of people say they're the skate rock pioneers. They were one of the first bands that you had to be a skateboarder if you're going to be in this band. And we're going to sing about skateboarding, said Locker. The influence between skateboarding and punk music is noticeable. At first, skateboarding was all flowery and beach-like and, you know, beach colors and whatnot. And then the kids started listening to punk rock, that skated, and they started getting that style into their skateboarding. It just kind of flourished from there to where they all just kind of intermingled, said Locker. Even Roffler agreed to that sentiment, saying both skateboarding and punk music are both very DIY, or do-it-yourself. Popularity of skating has only flourished since dry surf. There are now 3,500 skate parks in the U.S., according to the Public Skate Park Development Guide. As the skateboarding community flourishes, the sport has created a bond of community, family, and inclusivity. Skateboarding builds so many bridges. I have so many relationships still I'm total friends with, Locker says. It's just like this whole generational thing. Roffler also expressed his hope from the museum, hoping that people who aren't familiar with skateboarding broaden their minds to understand the inclusivity of the sport. The dry surf exhibit will be open to Tempe History Museum until January 23, 2026, and is free to the public. For more information, visit the Tempe History Museum's website or call 480-350-5100. You are listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Neil Kelly, and we'll continue with the news. The next article is titled, Bear Cub Spotted in Santan Valley Captured, Relocated, by Ren Smetana, Arizona Republic. A black bear cub recently spotted in Santan Valley was safely captured on October 25th to be relocated to the northern Arizona wilderness, according to officials. Last week, this little bear cub was spotted wandering in Santan Valley, but PCSO and Arizona Game and Fish Department were unable to track him and find probable cause for an arrest, the Pinal County Sheriff's Office said in a Facebook post. The cub, now called Ted, was seen a second time near Arizona Farms and Felix Roads. Deputies managed to corral him up a palm tree, where the rescue effort began, the post said. With assistance from the Arizona Game and Fish Department and Queen Creek Fire and Medical, Ted was tranquilized and removed from the tree, the post said. Rural Metro firefighters also supported the rescue, according to a separate Facebook post by Santan Valley firefighters IAFF Local 3878. Wildlife managers from the Arizona Game and Fish Department later released Ted into the wilderness of northern Arizona, where he can safely roam, the Pinal County Sheriff's Office said. The next article is titled, Woman Fatally Struck at Arizona Walmart, Three-Year-Old Taken to Hospital, by Jose R. Gonzalez, Arizona Republic. A woman was killed by a driver in a Goodyear Walmart parking lot, and a child at the scene was hospitalized, police said. Around 1:10 p.m. on October 23rd, officers responded to a call for service at the Walmart in the area of Australia Parkway and Roosevelt Street, according to Goodyear Police. A woman who was struck by a vehicle and received CPR died at the scene, police said. A three-year-old was taken to a hospital with injuries that were not life-threatening, police said. Impairment did not appear to be a factor, and there was no apparent criminal intent, according to police. Involved parties remained on the scene and are cooperating with police, the department said. The investigation remained ongoing, police said the evening of October 23rd. The next article is titled, Mesa Officer Injured in Police Shooting Near Gateway Airport by Michelle Cruz, Arizona Republic. A Mesa officer was injured during a shooting early on October 29th near Sossaman and Ray Roads, police officials said. Officials confirmed that a police shooting happened just after 2 a.m. near the intersection, which is also near Mesa Gateway Airport. Officers were called to the location about a man who was possibly inebriated and trespassing in a lot, according to Detective John Dreyer, a Mesa police spokesperson. They found the man inside a vehicle. "The man was immediately confrontational with officers and not listening to our directions," Dreyer said during a press briefing at the location. "The man ended up fleeing from our officers." A short time later, officers used a grappler device to stop and immobilize the vehicle. Dreyer said the man continued not to comply with or follow the officer's directions. He accelerated and tried unsuccessfully to break the device. Officers used less than lethal devices to try to gain the man's compliance. After a short standoff, the man fired rounds from inside of the vehicle towards officers, striking one of them, Dreyer said. The injured officer was taken to a hospital and is in stable condition, according to Dreyer. Officers continued to try to get the man to comply. After a standoff, officers heard a gunshot come from inside the vehicle and the man slumped over, Dreyer said. He was pronounced dead at the scene and police did not release his name. Multiple officers fired their weapons during the incident and the Gilbert Police Department will lead the part of the investigation. Dreyer said he could not confirm whether the gunshot that came from inside the vehicle immediately led to the man's death. "There are no outstanding suspects," Mesa Detective Jesse Macias, a department spokesperson, said in an earlier email. Residents were advised to avoid the area as Sossaman Road will be temporarily closed. Gateway Airport is accessible from the south, from Pecos Road, police said. There have been at least 63 police shootings in Arizona so far in 2025, with at least 45 of them being fatal. We move on to USA Today, and the first article there is titled, "Fed Meeting Live Updates. Fed Reduces Interest Rate by a Quarter Point," by Rachel Barber, Daniel DeVise, and Medora Lee, USA Today. The Federal Reserve on October 29th announced a quarter percentage point rate cut, marking its second consecutive rate reduction. The move brings the Fed's benchmark interest rate down to a range of 3.75% to 4%. Some economists think another cut could come at the Fed's December meeting, though a third consecutive reduction is not guaranteed. The two-day meeting took place amid the ongoing government shutdown, which delayed the September jobs report, a key piece of data that typically helps inform Fed decisions. Without that official data, policymakers turned to private sector indicators and went ahead with the cut, signaling greater concern about a cooling job market than lingering inflation. Generally, the Fed lowers interest rates to stimulate the economy and raises or holds them steady to curb inflation. The Fed kept rates steady for most of 2025, monitoring inflation and potential impacts of new tariffs. Recent weak employment numbers and softer inflation data, however, appear to have prompted the central bank to ease rates. Available indicators suggest that economic activity has been expanding at a moderate pace. Job gains have slowed this year, and the unemployment rate has edged up, but remained low through August, the Fed said in a statement judging that downside risks to employment rose in recent months. Of the Federal Open Market Committee's 12 voting members, 10 voted in favor of the action. Stephen Moran preferred a half percentage point cut, and Jeffrey Schmid preferred to hold rates steady. How are data delays affecting the Fed? While the government shutdown has postponed much of the Bureau of Labor Statistics' collection and dissemination of data, Powell said, "if there were a significant change in the economy one way or another, I think we'd pick that up." However, if the shutdown were to last until the Fed's next meeting in December, Powell said he could imagine a scenario in which committee members might want to proceed with more caution without official government data to guide them. "I'm not committing to that," Powell said. "I'm just saying it's certainly a possibility that you would say, we can't really see, so let's slow down." Powell acknowledged that job gains have slowed significantly since earlier in the year, suggesting a decline in the growth of the labor force due to lower immigration could be a reason why. Though labor demand has clearly softened as well, Powell added. Although the September jobs report was delayed, he said available evidence suggests both layoffs and hiring remain low. I think there are two things affecting the job market, Powell said. One of them is just a dramatic reduction in the supply of new workers. And that's two things. That's declining labor force participation, which is a cyclical thing. And then there's declining immigration, which is just a big policy change that actually began in the last administration and has been accelerated now. So a big part of the whole story is that supply side story. He continued, in addition, labor demand has declined. So the unemployment rate has gone down, meaning the demand for workers has gone down a little more than supply. That's what's going on, but it is mostly a supply function. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said the committee has not made a decision about whether or how it will adjust its benchmark rate in December. He said voting members shared strongly different views about how to proceed in December during the committee's two-day October meeting. A further reduction in the policy rate at the December meeting is not a foregone conclusion, Powell said. Far from it. Policy is not on a preset course. Lower interest rates can reduce borrowing costs for auto loans, personal loans, and credit cards. This can stimulate consumer spending and improve access to credit, particularly for those with tighter financial constraints, said Michelle Ranieri, Vice President and Head of U.S. Research and Consulting at TransUnion. For example, the average interest rate on a new credit card offer is now 24.19%, having fallen for the first time since March in the wake of the Fed's last cut, said Matt Schultz, Chief Consumer Finance Analyst at online financial products marketplace LendingTree. That downward trend is only going to accelerate in the next few months if the Fed cuts rates further, he said. Be mindful, though, that even if the Fed steps on the gas in the coming months when it comes to rate cuts, credit card rates aren't going to go from awful to amazing overnight, he warned. Lately, several Wall Street observers have warned the stock market may be in bubble territory. That's an analogy to the overhyped markets of 2008 and 1999, which crashed when those bubbles burst. There's talk of an AI bubble, overvalued tech stocks fueled by unrealistic expectations about the future of artificial intelligence. NVIDIA, the tech giant, became the first $5 trillion company on October 29th as its stock price surged. If the stock market is in a bubble, lower interest rates may help to inflate it. In comments to CNBC on October 28th, one investment expert predicted the AI boom won't end until the Fed begins raising interest rates, a move that will tighten the money supply. There's a lot of bubble stuff going on, said Ray Dalio, founder of Bridgewater Associates, speaking to CNBC. But bubbles don't pop, really, until they are popped by tightness of monetary policy and so on. When the Fed lowers interest rates, it aims to stimulate the economy and job market. Lower rates make loans and credit more affordable, benefiting borrowers and homebuyers. Raising rates, or keeping them higher for longer, slows spending to keep inflation in check. Higher rates can help consumers by stabilizing prices. Interest rates changes take time to ripple through the economy, often 6 months to a year, according to Dimitri Silva, Ream Asset Management's Managing Director and Head of Global Rates and Foreign Exchange. For everyday Americans, lower rates can translate to less interest paid on credit cards, car loans, and mortgages, making it a little easier to manage debt, Silva said. He added that cuts would help small businesses, key engines of job creation, that have struggled to weather high borrowing costs. Nearly every economic forecaster expects the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates at its October meeting. That doesn't mean it's a good idea. In a survey of 38 experts reported October 28th, CNBC found 92% believed the Fed would cut interest rates this month, but only 66% thought the cut was wise. Why not cut rates? One reason is that inflation sits at an annual rate of 3%, above the Fed's official target of 2%. Lower rates could raise prices further. Those who oppose a rate cut also worry about the shortage of economic data because of the government shutdown. Some also believe the Fed faces pressure from President Donald Trump to cut rates. Politics, rather than financial conditions, are clearly influencing the Fed's rate decisions, said Richard Bernstein, CEO of Richard Bernstein Advisors, speaking to CNBC. In an October 28th editorial, Bloomberg argued that the case for cutting is weak and that the Fed would be wiser to pause. The Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates on October 29th to shore up a weakening job market. How bad is it? There is no recent jobs data from the federal government because of the lingering shutdown. The next article is titled, Hurricane Melissa Moves Past Cuba After Hitting Jamaica. Death Toll Rises in Haiti. Updates by Found Nguyen, Dinah Voiles Pulver, Jeanine Santucci, Doyle Rice, and Christopher Can, USA Today. Deadly Hurricane Melissa made landfall in Cuba overnight and was churning out to sea on Wednesday as a Category 2 storm, as authorities in Jamaica began surveying the extensive damage left in its wake as the strongest tropical cyclone of the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season. In southern Haiti, torrential rain from Hurricane Melissa caused a river to burst its banks, killing at least 25 people, the mayor of Petit Goave, Jean-Bertrand Sabrimi, told the Associated Press Wednesday. He told the outlet that dozens of homes collapsed in the deluge and people were still trapped under rubble, overwhelming local authorities. In Jamaica, authorities said Wednesday that it's too early to confirm a death toll for the island nation. For those still awaiting Melissa's arrival, it's forecast to sweep through the central and southeastern Bahamas with hurricane-force winds overnight, bringing tropical storm-force winds early Wednesday afternoon. Bring a 4 to 7-foot storm surge and 5 to 10 inches of rain to the southeastern Bahamas. Pass west of Bermuda, but still bring heavy rains, swells, and rip currents beginning Thursday. The east end of Newfoundland also is in Melissa's probable path and could feel impacts on Friday night as it transitions from a hurricane to tropical storm. Thanks to the ferocity of Hurricane Melissa, the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season is now considered to be above normal, according to Colorado State University hurricane researcher Phil Klotzbach. He shared on X that the season has now generated 127 ACE, accumulated cyclone energy, making it an above-normal season per NOAA's definition. ACE is a measurement that reflects the intensity and duration of all tropical storms and hurricanes in a given season. 9 of the last 10 Atlantic hurricane seasons have been classified as either above-normal or extremely active, according to Klotzbach. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the United States has sent rescue and response teams to parts of the Caribbean devastated by the Hurricane Melissa. The United States is in close contact with the governments of Jamaica, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and the Bahamas as they confront the devastating impacts of Hurricane Melissa, he said in a post on X October 29th. We have rescue and response teams heading to affected areas along with critical life-saving supplies. Rubio did not describe the size of the rescue teams or say where they would be stationed. Our prayers are with the people of the Caribbean, he added. Jack Edma, 37, said Hurricane Melissa was a storm like no other he's ever experienced. At a home in eastern Jamaica, which avoided the worst of the Melissa's impacts, Edma felt the building's concrete walls vibrate as the storm barreled across the island. It was scary, he told USA Today on October 29th. It was so strong, I moved away from any windows that hid. The power went out, and as Edma went around St. Catherine Parish the next day, he saw roads covered in downed trees and overtaken by floodwater. One home had partially collapsed and fell over a cliff, he said. Edma, of Lynchburg, Virginia, said he was in the country on business when his flight was canceled over the weekend. While he awaits his return to the United States, he said he plans to assist in the cleanup effort, handing out food and clearing roads. The next article is titled, DoorDash, GoPuff, to offer grocery deals for SNAP recipients during November, by Melina Khan, USA Today. As funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, is set to run dry come November 1st, millions of people won't have their normal access to nutritious foods. However, a couple of meal and grocery delivery services are here to help. SNAP, also known as food stamps, is a federal program that provides monthly benefits to low-income individuals for healthy foods. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, which runs the SNAP, 42 million Americans rely on the program every month. Due to the ongoing government shutdown, SNAP currently lacks the normal federal funding it relies on to operate. The USDA said it can't tap into contingency funds to issue benefits, which are allocated monthly. Therefore, recipients won't receive their normal aid for November. In turn, food banks will likely bear the brunt of the lapse in SNAP benefits. However, some companies have announced deals for SNAP recipients, and local grocery stores may also have discounts. The grocery delivery company GoPuff, is offering $50 off groceries for SNAP recipients. The deal is available in two waves throughout November, $25 each for use on SNAP-eligible items. Here's how SNAP recipients can access the GoPuff discount, which will run in two waves. 1. Add a SNAP EBT card to your GoPuff account. 2. Add SNAP-eligible groceries to cart. 3. From November 1st to the 15th, use code SNAPRELIEF1 at checkout for $25 off SNAP-eligible items and free delivery. 4. From November 16th to the 30th, use code SNAPRELIEF2 at checkout for $25 off SNAP-eligible items and free delivery. SNAP recipients can use DoorDash without paying extra delivery or service fees on one order in November, the company announced on October 26th. The offer is available for customers who have linked a SNAP EBT card as a payment option on the DoorDash profile and place an order at eligible stores. They include Dollar General, Food Lion, Sprouts, Schnucks, Giant Foods, The Giant Company, Hannaford, Stop and Shop, Hy-Vee, Giant Eagle, Wegmans. A promo code is needed to redeem the offer, but users who have uploaded their SNAP EBT card as a payment method will see the code in the app during the promotion, which will be available from November 1st to November 30th, according to DoorDash. DoorDash said it expects to waive fees on about 300,000 orders as part of the promotion. The next article is titled, What Time Does Daylight Saving Time 2025 End? Here's Precisely When We'll Fall Back, by Julia Gomez and Fernando Cervantes Jr. Winter is slowly creeping closer, and days are getting shorter, which means daylight savings time is coming to an end. Daylight savings time always occurs on the second Sunday of March and ends on the first Sunday of November. Despite calls to make daylight savings time a permanent fixture in Americans' day-to-day lives, the time will change only 2 days after Halloween. Then our clocks fall back, and we gain that coveted extra hour of sleep. So at what time exactly will this happen? Here's what to know. When does daylight saving time end in 2025? Daylight saving time in 2025 will end on Sunday, November 2nd at 2 a.m. local time. Daylight saving time is the period between March and November when most Americans set their clocks forward by 1 hour. In March, set the clock forward to gain more daylight in the summer evenings, but when we fall back in November, it's to add more daylight in the mornings. The correct term is daylight saving, not savings, time. However, the incorrect term, daylight savings time, is commonly used, especially in Australia, Canada, and the United States. President Donald Trump previously supported the notion of eliminating daylight saving time. The Republican Party will use its best efforts to eliminate daylight saving time, Trump said on Truth Social in December 2024. Daylight saving time is inconvenient and very costly to our nation. But later this year, he said it was a toss-up and difficult to rally support for. This should be the easiest one of all, but it's a 50-50 issue. If something's a 50-50 issue, it's hard to get excited. I assume people would like to have more light later, but some people want to have more light earlier because they don't want to take their kids to school in the dark, Trump said in March, according to Reuters. A lot of people like it one way. A lot of people like it the other way. It's very even. Similar to his stance in 2019, per Politico, Trump in April said the House and Senate should push for more daylight at the end of the day. Currently, the following states and territories do not observe daylight saving time: Hawaii, Arizona, with the exception of the Navajo Nation, American Samoa, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands. The next article is titled, Dictionary.com names 6-7 as 2025 Word of the Year. Here's what it really means. By Greta Cross, USA Today. Dictionary.com has announced its 2025 Word of the Year, and if you're not up to speed on this year's slang, you may be puzzled by the outcome. The online dictionary announced on October 29th that its Word of the Year is 6-7, also 67 and 67, a slang phrase popularly used by Gen Alpha. While some interpret the phrase to mean so-so, or maybe this, maybe that, It's also used as an exclamation, according to a Dictionary.com news release. It's part inside joke, part social signal, and part performance. Steve Johnson, director of lexicography for the Dictionary Media Group at IXL Learning, said in a news release, "When people say it, they're not just repeating a meme, they're shouting a feeling. It's one of the first words of the year that works as an interjection, a burst of energy that spreads and connects people long before anyone agrees on what it actually means." The popular 6-7 phrase and accompanying hand movement, moving the hands up and down, palms up, like weighing two objects, even made a recent appearance on South Park. In the season 28 premiere of the cartoon, character Butters Scotch goes around to the elementary school saying different 6-7 jokes to his friends. "You want to know what time I woke up this morning?" Butters Scotch asks his friends. "Around 6-7. In response to his friends, say 6-7 back, both with glee and mirroring the popular hand movement. 6-7, in some capacity, has been milling around the internet for about 10 months now. Here's a look at how the slang got started. The origins of 6-7 tie back to the song Doot Doot, released by rapper Skrilla in December 2024. In the song, Skrilla sings, "The way that switch, I know he's dying 6-7. I just bipped right on the highway." According to Know Your Meme, a database for memes and internet slang, some people say 6-7 in the song is in reference to 67th Street, perhaps in Philadelphia, where Skrilla is from. But the rapper had not confirmed the number's meaning as of October 28th. The same day Doot Doot was released, TikTok user Matvi Greenblatt posted a video of Charlotte Hornets point guard LaMelo Ball. In the video, Greenblatt discusses Ball's height, which is 6'7". At this point in the video, the lyric from Doot Doot, in which Skrilla sings 6-7, is dubbed. As of October 28th, the TikTok video had 10.1 million views. And that is all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Neil Kelly. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.